Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News. And now we're in depth and on the road with a couple with a lot at stake. Hours into their drive east, Mark looks over at his wife, Maggie, and thinks that living with her is sometimes like living with a stranger. It was like he didn't recognize a single thing about his wife. But I recognize that I was in the hands of someone who was tuned in to that frequency that hums between couples who know each other well. Or not. Writer Hannah Pittard has said she looks for the, quote, beside-the-point moments that often reveal what the story is really about. We'll talk about that. And I'm interested in where we might find the emotional autobiography in her books. This is something that Jacqueline Woodson talked about yesterday, and it really struck me. So maybe Hannah and I will talk about that, too. As she joins us, I thought it might be fun to hear from you about a road trip you've taken like no other, because that's a key element of this novel. Who was it with? Where'd you go? What'd you find out about yourself along the way? So I'm looking for your stories of a road trip, who you went with, where you went, and what you discovered about yourself. Think about it. Join us, 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828. You can tweet me. You might even tweet me a photo of that road trip on Twitter. It's at Carrie NPR. Hannah Pittard's new novel is titled Listen to Me, and she's with us today from Lexington, Kentucky. And Hannah, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Carrie.
I noted a number of those beside-the-point moments in this book. And okay, so here's how I think of that. They're moments that don't seem to have a lot of significance at the time, but they're also the moments as a reader, when you're putting it all together kind of at the end, they shimmer with more significance than they did when you were reading them. Does that explanation make sense to you?
Oh, I think that explanation is perfect, right? I mean, that's what makes up our lives, the little, you know, the little things that happen every single day. And at the end of a day, we find that we've had several hours behind us and we've made choices, sometimes big ones, sometimes small ones, and then you've got a series of days and suddenly it's a week and suddenly it's a month and suddenly it's a year, but it's all about those tiny little moments and adding them up and the things they become.
So the challenge for you, the novelist, is to make them seem spontaneous and insignificant in the moment, even though if you know where the novel is going in some larger sense, you know that this is a moment that's going to mean something. Am I explaining?
Sure. Yeah, that's right. It's a hard job because you want to keep the reader surprised, but you also want to earn the revelations
exactly.
That they do encounter.
Exactly. Yeah. So how do you think about that? So how do you calibrate that? The earning of the revelation, but the surprise?
I'm a very instinctive writer. I try very hard to tell the truth about my characters, and I don't always know where a story is going when I get started. And as the characters come more and more into view, I want to make sure that what they're doing on the page is true to who they have become. So I am often, I luck out a lot. I think I luck out.
And okay.
That's right. I'm recently divorced as well. And I do think you were mentioning, what was the phrase that was so great? Emotional autobiography?
Yeah.
Yeah. I pay a lot of attention to couples. I think they're really interesting. And by couple, I can mean anything from a mother and a daughter to siblings. You know, there's wherever there's a relationship, there's something to watch. And I was really interested with this book in trying to tell the story not just of Mark and Maggie, but the larger story of the way the pet vocabularies that people who have lived together in some capacity, in some serious capacity, people who have lived together for a long time, I'm interested in those vocabularies that they develop over time.
Oh, my gosh. You know, that was kind of the exact note that I made. In some ways, I think I ought to just ask you to read the excerpt, because you nailed that thing that, you know, sometimes with somebody that you know really well, you're kind of play arguing, but you're really not. But any second it could tip over into a real argument. And you did that. So it felt so real to me.
Thank you.
Okay. What would you say? Should we read that excerpt? I don't usually do it this early in the conversation, but it just fits to where we are.
Sure.
At.
Okay. I'm happy to.
All right. Set it up a little bit, if you will. Yeah.
Sure. This is the beginning of chapter 10, and the chapters go back and forth from Mark's perspective to Maggie's perspective. They've been driving quite a few hours, as you mentioned, and the rain, they're driving in the direction of a storm, and the rain has just started to pick up, and they've both discovered that in their haste leaving that morning, they have forgotten to pack themselves any food. This is a couple that would be sort of efficient in general and would have, you know, a bag of organic groceries in the back seat, and they've realized that they didn't do that this go-round. And so this is the beginning of chapter 10, and it's from Mark's point of view. "Just park, and I'll walk with you," Mark said. "No point in both of us getting soaked," Maggie said. She had pulled over at the curb of a squat brick building with neon cacti and sombreros in the windows. "Seriously," he said, "just park. We'll go in together." The wipers, still hiked up to their fastest speed, went quiet when Maggie put the car in park, and now the front windshield was a streaming mess of water and neon. "This is stupid," she said. Jerome, their dog, stood up in the back seat and yawned. "I'm not getting out without you," said Mark. "Fine," she said. The truth was, Mark made Maggie nervous when it came to parking. He should have just gotten out of the car like she wanted, but what kind of husband left his wife alone to park in the rain? The lot was surprisingly full. She circled it once, then twice, passing up two different empty spots. "You hated those spots?" Mark said. Maggie shook her head. "There's one," he said. "Another one." She was still shaking her head. "You're mad?" "Stop talking," she said. "Park," he said. She slammed on the brakes. They were back at the curb. "Get out," she said. He laughed because it was ridiculous. "You get so worked up. You treat me like a child. You act like a child." "I'm not hungry anymore," she said. Jerome gave a little yowl. "Well, I am," Mark said, "so park the car." He could see Maggie was on the brink of laughter, but determined not to let it out. With his forefinger and thumb, he zipped his lips shut, then swallowed an invisible key. She put the car into drive and did another lap. "So you know," she said, "it's not that I think I can't park with you in the car." He pointed to his lips and shrugged, eyes wide. "I just want a spot where I can see the car from inside," she said. "I want to be able to check on Jerome." "You think someone is going to steal the dog?" "I thought you swallowed the key," she said. "In this weather?" "So you didn't swallow the key," she said. "You were lying." "I keep a spare in my pocket," he said. In spite of herself, she laughed. "Should have known," she said.
Well done. You know, the thing that I loved about that scene, too, is there's a lot of emotional intelligence going on between those two people. And then there's not, right? They're kind of childish, but they also know each other well enough to just push it. Yeah, I mean, they've become intelligent about each other's buttons, and that happens in a relationship.
Oh, I absolutely agree. This scene, it was hard for me to read it without laughing, because I swear this has happened to me and to my ex-husband, almost possibly verbatim.
Really?
And I do recall being so angry. And then he you know, mentioned that he had a spare key in his pocket. And I was so angry then because he had charmed me, because that's funny. And it's what I love about this scene is that they are clearly, there's a lot of tension in the car, but there's also a lot of love. But there's also, as you say, there's this emotional tension. There's this emotional intelligence that often means, instead of having the argument or fight that they might ought to have in order to make progress, they're both so good at changing the direction of the conversation that they never really get to have a satisfying conversation.
Which you need to have on a long road trip at some point, right? If you've just tuned in, I'm having a conversation with Hannah Pittard about her new novel, Listen to Me. And you hear us talking about the setup here, this couple. They've been together a while. They know each other pretty well. They get into the car with... I guess I'm thinking of this as with a lot at stake, a few things that they're keeping from one another, and they set off on this road trip, which led me to think about maybe you joining in here with some experiences from a road trip that told you something about yourself, something, and that can be, I learned that I'm not... fill in the blank, or it was the best road trip ever, fill in the blank. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at Carrie NPR. Hey, tweet me a photo from that road trip. You could do that. To Maureen in Shoreview. Maureen, this sounds intriguing. Tell me about, did you just come back from this road trip? Is that right?
I just got back a week ago.
Where'd you go and who with?
So an old friend who I thought I knew well, the idea was to drive through Canada into Alaska. And the further we drove north, the more I found that my companion had these ridiculous rules. I do not ask for directions. I do not turn around. You're going to love this. I do not read a map.
There will be no map reading? Why?
There will be no map. So
this can't be a woman. It cannot.
Oh, it is.
No,
oh,
really?
Me, it is.
Oh, wow.
So she got more and more obstinate, and she became a bully and all this weird stuff. And at one point, I said, you know, we just, oh, and she wouldn't take main roads. And Saskatchewan had flooding. So we really did need to take main roads. And I said, you know, I just really would feel more comfortable if we took some, you know, not, let's not take any more gravel roads. And she said, you know, I'm going to drive the way I want to drive, and I can drop you off. And that, to me, was a threat. So at the next gas station, I saw a sign that said Bus Depot. It was a little town, Kelleher, Saskatchewan, about 200 people, and I got out.
Did you really? And that's it?
And I spent the next 3 days taking buses across Canada.
Oh, my gosh, Maureen.
To get to Seattle and fly home. It was the best trip after I left her.
Whoa, I'm so glad you heard the show. It strikes me, Hannah, that Maureen and her friend needed a little more of that emotional intelligence we were just talking about.
Well, it's funny. I was thinking if I were to write a story about them, it would be really important to me so that the friend didn't become a caricature or simply a stereotype. It would be really important for me to spend some time trying to figure out what was really going on in her head, right? There's a whole narrative that we don't have access to. I'm wondering why there are no maps, why you don't go on the main roads. And that could either get really funny really fast or very sinister very fast. As Maureen said, she felt threatened.
I was thinking about also the setup that you have for, you know, a road trip novel, and there are so many. There's the standard that everybody thinks they know, and that's Kerouac's On the Road. But
sure,
there have been some, I think, cool innovations on the idea of the road trip. And I was thinking of Emily St. John Mandel's Station 11. Have you read that?
Oh, absolutely. I'm a huge fan of Emily's.
Okay, so isn't that's a road novel in a way that I think we typically don't think of them? Do you agree with that?
I do. I agree with that. I also think, as you say, there's just such a legacy for this type of exploring America. And I always think of Lolita as one of the best road trip novels ever written. And that's an interesting conversation to get started because some people will disagree, but it's such a keen look at America from one stop to the next.
Yeah. So you've read Dennis Johnson, right? Isn't he one of your favorite
writers? I admire his writing like nobody's business, yeah.
And you've read Angels.
Yes.
Yeah. So what kind of
That's a tough one.
Yeah, tell me why. I haven't read it, but when I thought about road novels, and unexpected road novels, that was one of the titles that popped up.
Yeah, he does a really wonderful job of and a much better job, I think, than I do, but he does a really great job of finding the universal in the specific. And you know, you might never have been on a bus like the one that he takes you on, and you might never have been on a trip similar to the one that he takes you on. But there is something so just universal about what he's showing us, about the way that humans interact with one another, so that even though you might think that you don't know anybody in your life who are like his characters, there is something that, as you're reading along, makes you think, wow, how does he know me so well? I've never seen a thought articulated so clearly. He's very good at distilling patterns in humanity, I think.
But you say that's a tough novel to read.
There's some brutality in it. There's some violence, which is not to say that it shouldn't be read. But yeah, it's got some moments that are difficult.
Call here from Katya in St. Paul. Hey, hi, thanks for waiting.
Hi, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can. Tell us about
Great,
your road
sure.
trip.
Well, we basically took a one-year road trip as a family. We bought a used RV. My husband left one job, and we sort of restarted our life midlife, and it was an incredible. It was just the best experience, but I laughed with your reading because we certainly had moments like that of just living in 37-foot RV the whole year. And
wow.
And my mom was just amazed. She said, and you got back and you're not getting a divorce. And
I know.
It brought us closer together. And I have to say, like, that year I felt more at home than I ever have felt in any of the homes or places where I've lived, just traveling with my family. So it really crystallized some things about, you know, what am I going to do in retirement, and kind of this wanderlust / restless spirit, and just how it jived. And it was the best ever. So we can't wait to get in an RV again and just kind of live on the road.
Boy.
Down the road, so to speak.
You know, what strikes me about what you said, Katya, is you said we restarted our life, that there is a kind of before and after with this experience for you.
Yeah, it was a reset button, and it was great. And then we come back to our relatively small St. Paul home, and it just feels big, and we feel like we have too much stuff. And I think that experience, we were so fortunate to do it and to drive all around America and see these iconic places and stay in Chattanooga for 10 days, which we would otherwise never think to go to. So it just exploring and yet the mundane things of, you know, making tuna fish sandwiches and getting sick of that and getting lost. And I did not like parking the giant truck that we had to have to pull the RV. And so, you know, all that, the details that in that one scene that the author read were excellent. I can't wait to read the book.
Good, so. Good. That's the goal of the interview, Katya. Thank you. You grew up in Atlanta, Hannah? Is that right?
I was born and somewhat raised in Atlanta. I was there until I was about 14 and then went off to boarding school in Western Massachusetts.
Okay. And you're in Lexington now, but you've lived in Chicago too, right?
Yeah, I'm in Lexington, Kentucky. I've been here for 2 years. Before that, I was in Chicago for 5. I happened to have done my undergraduate work in Chicago, but that was quite a while ago. And I ended up back in Chicago on the north side teaching at DePaul.
Can I ask if you feel where you feel rooted in your life?
That's a really good question. That's quite insightful. And it's something that I spend not a small portion of many days, most days probably, thinking about that. Because I went to high school in a city other than where I was born, and because I don't go back to that city where I went to high school and my parents don't live in Western Massachusetts, home for me... This might seem like a cliche, but there's a reason that cliches become cliches because of those patterns that we see over and over again. But home is where my family is, and it's where my brother and sister and my brother's kids and my mom, it's where they congregate, whether it's during a holiday or not. That's what's always going to feel like home to me. And I've gotten good at, not needing a place to define that feeling and letting the people who love me and who I love help define it instead.
You know, I mentioned the emotional autobiography piece of this that I talked to Jacqueline Woodson about, and that resonated with you. But this is interesting because at the end of the interview, she mentioned that she and her family are probably going to spend a year in, she is so firmly rooted in Brooklyn, but they are probably going to spend a year in Italy. And she said, that's going to shake her up a lot because she's so accustomed to feeling so connected in that place in Brooklyn, but that it's something she kind of thinks she needs.
Oh, and she's probably right. I think we all need to be shaken up. I think, I'm an educator. I'm a professor at the University of Kentucky, and I certainly believe that the way we learn, whether we're 18 to 22 or 37 or 57, but the way we learn is with a certain amount of discomfort and by taking the different way home than we normally do. And because we take a different route on Thursday than we've taken every day before then, we see something that we might not have seen. And seeing that thing, noticing that detail, it makes a thought occur that we wouldn't have had, and our lives change just a little at a time because of that. I think she's absolutely right to get out of Brooklyn and go to Italy. And she's also right, it's going to shake things up.
There might be a before and after for her, you know, in some ways, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I read your essay from 2014 on getting into and getting out of some pretty serious debt. That's a brave thing. To write about. It is. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, as a writer, and I know I'm primarily a fiction writer, but whether I'm writing fiction or essays, as I said at the beginning of this interview, it's really important to me to tell the truth. And in my fiction, what I'm often trying to do is sort of solve a puzzle or to have a conversation with myself and ultimately, if I'm lucky, with readers about problems that are nagging at me. And clearly, Listen to Me is a story about marriage and about this strange institution that we willingly enter into, even though it is clearly madness. It's about that, but it's also about technology and our increasing reliance on it. I am increasingly reliant on my iPhone, and I am increasingly uncomfortable with that reliance. So it's important to me to have these conversations. And I think you were asking me about the debt, and that was, writing that essay was, it was sort of like the final step in coming clean. I don't think I would have been able to write it if I'd still had the debt. And my family was not aware of how significant or how bad it was. And I think that was my way of confessing, but there's enough pride in me, and I'm very, very independent. And I, you know, on the Enneagram scale, I definitely register as an achiever. And so I was unable to admit just how bad the situation was until I'd fixed the problem. And so that essay was sort of me coming clean and also maybe like putting a flag up to my family to say, hey, I'm capable of this. Please pay attention.
You know, you put a storyline of that into one of your novels, didn't you? Was it in Reunion?
I did.
Or
it's
which
in my
one?
Second novel, in Reunion.
Yeah.
The numbers that the character Kate, there's a chapter in which she outlines exactly what her bills are. Those numbers... Those numbers
they're pretty
exist
accurate,
for a
are they?
They're pretty accurate.
Okay. Call here from Caleb in St. Paul. Hi, Caleb.
Hi.
Hi. Tell me
Thank
what you're
you
thinking
for
about.
Taking my call.
Yeah.
Yeah. My wife and I were listening to the show, and I started thinking about a car ride we had from San Antonio to Northampton, Massachusetts.
Wow, that's a ways.
With our cat. Yeah, it was quite a drive. And it was only after that car ride that I got the diagnosis of schizotypal personality disorder. But being in a car for so long, it was during that ride that we started to figure out that, you know, something might be sort of off, or better explained by the DSM-5 than anything. And it was during that car ride that we started to notice this hypervigilance that, and then what would be delusions if Aaron hadn't figured out how to sort of bring me back to kind of seeing things not in a more delusional sort of way. You know, I would take a left turn randomly because I would think that the cars behind me were, you know, following me or something like that. And, you know, so for us, rather than, you know, being a bad sort of experience, it was a growing experience.
It's kind of a revelation. Caleb, I have to say this, that there's an element of, I will just say, it's kind of this overwhelming anxiety in this character, Hannah, that you've created, that is not all that separate, I guess, from what Caleb is describing.
No, it's not. And it sounds like that's a car ride that they were really lucky to have taken, and right, taken when they did. I think it's funny. The idea for this book in some ways goes back to my time at the University of Virginia when I was a graduate student. And I had a wonderful writer and professor called Chris Tillman. And Chris told us early on, you know, there are writers who, some of them, they know exactly what they want to write about, but they can't find the words. And there are other people who have the words, but they don't have the plots. And, you know, everyone runs into their own sorts of writer's block at times. And Chris gave this great piece of advice that must have just sort of taken root a decade ago, and it didn't really come to life until this book. But he offered the advice, if you're having a hard time writing about something, if you're having a hard time making action happen or letting a story unfold, put two people in a car who don't like each other and something's going to happen. And
so
I think the flip side to that is put a family in an RV for a year. Mm. Something's going to change. Put a couple in a car and have them drive across 10 states to Northampton, Massachusetts, and discoveries will be made about, and they might be small revelations. It might be that, as in my book with Mark and Maggie, there are crushes that never get revealed, but Mark falls sort of in love and then out of love with a graduate student of his own. And, you know, Caleb and his wife had this huge discovery. It's just so interesting what happens when you put people in very close proximity. It's the noise of the outside world drowns out, and we find ourselves really having to pay attention. And that means something's going to happen.
I was thinking, Hannah, of some fun music that we could close our interview with. And I thought of John Prine and his story of not Mark and Maggie, but Donald and Lydia. Do you know the song?
Oh, one of my favorites. I learned how to
really
tell stories from John Prine.
Did
oh,
you?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yeah.
Perfect.
Donald and Lydia is, you're going to break my heart playing this. I can't wait.
This has been such a pleasure. Please come back.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Hannah Pittard's novel is called Listen to Me.